This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling particularly musical today.
No.
Yes.
That's not like you.
Well, I have just been in a taxi getting here, and by some weird synchronicity, the driver was playing kind of old Bob Marley records, which is kind of linked in a way to today's guest, because today's guest is really inspired by dub music and
reggae
and
the West kind of, Indian music,
and the kind of club scene, you know, all the way from the kind of 1980s to the present day,
and kind of the British club scene.
Yeah, definitely. And it brought back lots of memories for me, because when I was growing up at the age of 11, my brother was a DJ, and he was particularly into like house music. That's where he ended up in the club scene, but he was initially really inspired by reggae and dub. So I grew up from a young age with him with his turntables in the house playing kind of Lee Scratch Perry records, you know, obviously the more mainstream things like Bob Marley, but that's such a big part of my childhood. And sadly, he ended up passing away. And even in his funeral, they played Buffalo Soldier by Bob Marley.
No.
So for a long time, I wasn't even able to listen to like reggae music, because he used to really sort of bring back all the memories of my brother
passing
away.
Was that your mom and dad's choice to play that?
Yeah, I guess it was all of us. I think we did it in the funeral. I really remember Bob Marley's voice, like in the church when he died. But so for a long time I couldn't hear it. But now hearing it in a car today, like, it brings back really happy memories, because I've kind of come through all the grief and you know, I've got there 20 years later, whatever, 25 years later.
Wow.
But yeah, and it was quite a profound thing today to have that in the car, as I've been thinking a lot about kind of history of dub music anyway. So yeah, I forgot I had my own little personal link to it.
Yeah.
But today's guest is an incredible painter, and we have been admirers of his work for a few years now. And I first discovered him through Matthew Higgs at White Collins in America. He was actually showing him, I think even in maybe in like NADA at an art fair booth once. I think I saw a drawing by this artist, which I really loved. And I remember photographing it and then sort of investigating the work. And that was the first discovery. And it was only literally like 2 years ago,
three years ago. Yeah.
But he's been making work for a long time, and I can't wait to speak with him.
Yes.
So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Denzel Forrester.
Hello, Talk Art.
Welcome.
I've been doing it for over 40 years.
I know.
It's the doing of it that's important. The making of it.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be at this stage now, 40 years into your career, and having all this attention on you?
Well, it's just amazing, because I'm 63. I'll be 64 next year. And I've been doing this for, like I said, just over 40 years now. And everything started happening in 2015 through meeting Peter Doig, a well-known artist who's about 2 years younger than me, who basically have given me a leg up, really. I mean, he saw my work over 35 years ago when I was a student at my MA show at the Royal College in 1983. That's the first time he saw my MA show.
Wow.
And he loved it, but he was a mess student at St. Martin's then, so he couldn't do anything about it. Fast forward 35 years, he contacted me in 2015. I was working at Morley College. I was going to be retired.
You were teaching there, right?
Teaching. I've been teaching there for 30 years. I started teaching there since 87, 88.
Amazing.
So I was going to retire in 2016. Peter Doig emailed me in 2015. It went into my junk mail because he's not on my system. My partner found it in my junk mail and just said, this guy Peter Doig is interested. He's just going to send you an email.
No way.
So I thought, what the hell is Peter Doig want from me? So I emailed him back and you say, what do we want and stuff? He said, could we meet up in Dalston? I want to talk to you about your work, your painting. I thought, that's strange. Anyway, so we met down Dalston. I was meant to meet him about 12 o'clock, 12:30 one Sunday. I waited, 12:30 came, he didn't turn up. I thought, bloody hell, he's messing me about. So I went back to my, I had a flat in Stokey, went back to Stoke Newington, emailed him. He is coming on a train from Germany to meet me at 12:30.
Wow.
And his train was delayed. So he reckoned, could we meet in an hour or so? So I went back to Dalston and we met about 1:30, 2:30. And he said, yes, I saw your work at the Royal College in 83 and really liked it. I wonder if you still have it and have you got all your stuff? And I would want to give you an exhibition in my gallery in Shoreditch. This guy's crazy. It couldn't be. So I went and looked at his gallery. I thought, God, this is amazing space.
This is the Tramps Gallery.
Tramps,
isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, Tramps in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
And so I loved it and I said, yes. And Peter was on his way back in 2015. Going back to Trinidad because he grew up in Trinidad as a youth till he moved to Canada when he was 12. Anyway, so he emailed me saying, I found another venue for your exhibition at White Columns, New York.
Wow.
Matthew Higgs Gallery.
I thought,
this guy is a bit, this is too much.
Yeah.
So he and Matthew came down in 2016, summer, around June time, because I moved to Cornwall in 2015 because I was retiring. Because I moved all my work from London.
But you're still painting every day. Do you paint and draw every day?
Yeah, that's the main objective. I was stopping when I was 60. I was 60 in 2016, so I stopped teaching because I've been teaching 3 days a week, which is like part-time, and painting the next 3 days a week.
Right.
But, teaching is very demanding. It's like having 40 kids a week,
and they all
need your attention.
And I guess you also have all of their own creative issues that you then sort of take on. And because if you're a good teacher, you probably really emotionally invest in it.
Well, that's it. It's like, fine, everyone is an individual and he's bringing out their own vision out.
Yeah.
And some of them stayed with me for like 10, 15 years. When I tell them I was leaving after, spending so long with me, they were in a state of shock.
It was like a marriage.
Exactly.
I'm like, where are you going?
Anyway, so Peter and Matthew came down, 2016, summer, about June, July, looked at over 40 years of my work.
No way.
Literally. Well, all my work. I had this massive big barn in Cornwall I rented because the paintings are quite big, they're 10 feet. 3-4 meters.
Did you store them all yourself? Like you wrapped them and protected them? And
Well, that's the thing. People think making paint, but you got to actually have a big storage.
Yeah.
You do a big work.
Yeah.
You got to make sure it's not damp.
Yeah.
And when you have lots of them, oh God, it's more difficult because they could easily get scratched and all sorts. Anyway, they looked at all the work I've done and selected two exhibitions, one for Tramps, London, and one for White Column, New York. Matthew selected all the early 80s, mainly Jashaka, Dalston, Foasis, Thebes, that sort of those.
No,
sort
so
of
these, are cl- these are clubs. So Jashaka was...
Jashaka used to play at Thebes. Jashaka is the DJ. He's the ultimate DJ, Jashaka. He's been doing it since he was around 18, I think. He must be in his late 60s now.
Yeah, he's still going strong, isn't he?
He's still going strong.
He was your hero.
Well, he was my hero because he really... The thing he did for the youth, Jashaka, is incredible because you could go and see Jashaka now and there's people in their 50s and 60s who used to follow him when he was a youth.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's you.
He was a real pioneer, wasn't he?
Yeah, so I hadn't drawn Jashaka for over 30 years and I went and drew him about 2-3 weeks ago at Ludbrook Grove. I was playing beneath the flyover. So he was incredible and he's still... got the energy.
And what does he look like? What is so like appealing about his image, about what he...
Well, he's the ultimate performance artist, really. He's not just a DJ. He toasts, rap on the mic, he's messing about with the record. He mixes, he brings in all the different sirens, whatever his pole is or whatever, he dances.
But visually, what is it about him that you're kind of slightly transfixed by to follow him around in your early days?
Well, he's got, it's an energy, isn't he? He's got an energy that is difficult to explain these things verbally. It's not just to do with him, but it's he and his song system.
What he creates.
The machine, because he's always, you know, playing his song system. Then there's the crowd around him. Mm. He's got about 5 or 6 people who really work with him. And so it's not just him, but it's the whole setup. His machine and the crowd around him, you know, it's a big thing, really.
And I think your work really captures that atmosphere. And there's a sense with, I think there's a type of sound system that Jar Shaker actually, you know, kind of promoted in a way, which is this kind of mono sound system, which actually is much more like a punch almost to your body. It's when the sound hits you, it's very different to stereo sound, just for our listeners to understand.
That's a bass thing. That's like a solid bass.
Well, reggae is a much more, to me, is a much more aggressive music.
Right.
You know, drum and bass. That's, you know, you got to understand drum. And when you go to one of those events in those days, you'd be in a basement.
Yeah.
There's no way to run. The music is, you'll be sweating for the first half an hour because the music just goes through your whole body.
Yeah.
It'll take you like half an hour to get used to the bass. You know, because there's nowhere to go. You're in a basement in Dalston.
Yeah.
You know, there's no hardly any lights. There's a tiny little 60-watt Jashaka has a bulb there to play his records. That's about it. So it's dark. The music is like, ooh, and people are moving like crazy. I mean, you could just see, because I was there to actually not capture, but feel and draw that energy.
You want to harness, your works harness that energy.
Yeah. I mean, that gave me something to work. So when I come to my canvas, because I made the drawings to the length of a record. So a record in those days, like 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So I'll draw, the crowd goes mad, I'll go mad on my A1 paper. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I'll stop when the record stops. If they don't go mad for the next record, I don't draw.
Oh, it's only if the crowd go mad for the song.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
And where do you position yourself to do this in the club?
You've got to have a very good view of the DJ.
Right.
And the crowd.
Yeah.
So usually I'm at a side angle, more from the back side. So back and profile. So I've got a back of Jashaka sometime, because he's moving. He moves, you know, he doesn't stand still because he dances as well. So you got to be about 8-9 feet away.
Yeah.
From him.
Yeah.
So, because basically there was no way for me to stand on the dance floor. So I used to be behind the bar.
Wow.
And the bar would be about 4 feet wide and 6-7 feet long.
So would they hate you because you'd be getting in the way on busy nights?
Well, probably they did, but I didn't care. I had to go and draw.
But how did you connect to that relationship with these clubs that they allowed you to sort of take up that space in their...
Well, those song systems were like, I would say 60, 70% Rastafarians.
Right.
And the Rastafarians, they love art and culture.
Yes.
In those days, those man and woman come all dressed up in the regalia, you know. They look as like princes and princesses.
Amazing.
You know, headgear and, you know, feel proud. And if they say, you're an artist, man, come and draw me. And someone would just come and say, draw me, and I'll have to draw them because I'm there.
What, and they'd just stand in front of you?
They'd stand in front of me, yeah. And they'll say, draw me, man, draw me. And I'll do it for 5 or 10. So it'll be totally different as opposed to the drawings I'm doing of the whole crowd.
Yeah.
The drawing I'm doing of the whole crowd is called gesture drawings.
Okay.
It's to do with movement, action, and expression of what you feel that those bodies are doing out there. What's making them move? What's the sound doing to them? And if you capture it, you capture it. If you don't, you don't. Now, if someone comes in front of me and say, "Draw me," obviously I have to change that type of energy.
Yeah,
I'm not just doing a pure gesture drawing.
Yeah.
It has a little bit of gesture because I have to do it quick. But I'm not doing about 200 figures going crazy on the dance floor. Usually, I'll take about 20. You know, because I do small groups. So it's a totally different energy. And it's interesting because you're interrupting their space and they come and ask you to do something. You have to do it.
Yeah, of course.
You cannot just ignore
them. It's respectful. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's good for me. It was good for me because it's making you interact with the crowd in a different way. But that was just more, because there is two parts to the club. There is the more disco R&B with lovers rock, which is the top bit. So it's more like mellow, softer music that starts about 11 till 1. Mm. And that's the top part of the club I used to go. The basement is Josh Shaka. So Josh Shaka come in about, say, 1 o'clock, and it'll take him about, say, about 40 minutes to set up, you know, because it's all mono valve system. The speakers are in his truck. So they had to carry all those massive speakers from his big truck outside, set them up, wire them up. Then he'll do his amplifier, you know, which is about six feet high on his own. And then, of course, you'll get his big bag of spliff out, lights up, whoosh, and oh, here you go. I mean, it was just like, those things, if you haven't been to one, it's difficult to explain it. And I suppose that's the exciting thing about me being there, drawing and trying to sort of harness that energy of that time.
Would you go into like a trance-like state on these drawings?
Well, you probably will, because there'll be a lot of weeds. Remember, those people smoke weed.
Yeah.
People are allowed to smoke and do whatever you want.
Would you do that while you was working?
No, I don't smoke. I never smoke. But the room is full of, you could smell it. You can taste it.
You take it on. Yeah.
You know, so you'll be sort of, I'm taking it in. But also,
I think the music has such a massive impact as well to your mood and to your emotional state in a way. Because that in itself can be quite a transcendent.
Transform you. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
that will transform you.
And I've heard you before describe it as a kind of deep hypnotic ancestral beat. Yeah. And I remember really clearly my brother saying to me, one of the reasons he really related to that style of music was because of this concept of kind of freedom somehow.
Yeah.
And I love the way you describe all of that.
Well, that's why I think so much people used to go to it. And I think they look forward, what is the main thing at the end of the week.
Right.
I mean, it's Friday and Saturday. It's like going back in your kind of, I don't know, prehistoric time when, you know, people probably used to do those things naturally in the evening, worshiping stuff, and you know, but you don't get a lot of that now. In the place, your places where you can go and just feel free, let everything come out of you. And that's what I think that the Josh Shaka was good, because he allowed a lot of people, well, then was young people, of course, you know, that space to come in. And it's like being under the stars. I mean, when I was in the West Indies, because I was born in Grenada, I wasn't born in Jamaica, so it was more carnival. And you'll turn up at the junction every evening, and there'll be still band playing, there'll be people dancing, and they'll be making new music. So you'll be there for about 3 or 4 hours every evening, because you're leading up to carnival, you see. So when you come to London, there's none of that. Mm. What do you do? Yeah, of course, people started having house parties,
right.
Blues parties.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, in your front room, you got your little stereo and you invite your friends.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I used to be my mom's DJ, you see, when I was like, you know, what, 13, 14.
Yeah.
So that's how those things started.
Well, she'd have a party at house and at home, and you'd be there DJing for all of her friends.
That's it. So they'll have a party every month.
Would you ever draw her friends? Did you ever do anything like that?
No. I had to play the music.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting, because that idea of family as well. I think the club's almost become like this extended family.
That's it. So it started in people's front rooms in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, the new generation came. And they had to have their two speakers and their deck, you know, young people and their ghetto blasters. And that's when they start getting big spaces, big nightclubs, big cinemas and stuff like that. And then the whole thing went from your front room into a big open space, open arena.
Wow.
Started with the old cinemas, and then, of course, big pubs, basically. I mean, Thebes used to be, I think the Craig used to go to Thebes when in the 50s and 60s.
The Craigs?
The Craig Brothers.
Really?
Yes, yeah. Well, it's Hackney.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that's their stomping ground.
Yeah. It's not there anymore, though, is it?
It's a bloody posh flats now.
Is it?
No.
Yeah, it's a shame all those places have been bloody bought out. And turning, I mean, there's no kind of social places for big crowds to go, you know, and be as one as a community, basically, you know, because it's a communal space, basically.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Granada and you.
For 10 years.
Yeah, for 10 years. At the age of 11, moved to England.
Yeah.
So do you remember that being a drastic kind of, because it must have been such a shock coming to London when suddenly you don't have the kind of nature you would have had, I guess, surrounding you, but also the weather and I guess the houses and just the whole thing was so different to you. Was that a real shock?
Well, I was a country boy.
Yeah.
I mean, a house would be a little shack.
Right.
You know, so you come to London, it's dark, it's damp, it smells. And of course, that's just after the smog, because I came in 67.
Right.
So we were just coming out, London was just coming out of all that smog stuff.
What's I mean, the smog stuff? I didn't
like experience it. You know, the fireplaces.
Yeah, they used to have really terrible pollution. Yeah. They'd just be like black skies almost.
So it'll be dark. I mean, it's amazing, London, the change, because the Windrush people experienced it.
Yes.
I didn't. I just missed it. But there was just echoes of it. So that's, anyway, so it was dark, damp. And the houses, I was shocked at the size of the houses. They were like churches.
Right.
They were so big. The only big buildings you have in the West Indies when I was, there would be the church. So, and some of the houses over here, you'll look up and you might see a cross on top of one.
Right.
And oh, I thought, God, they're a bit religious. So anyway, I came over. Then went to my mom's house. My mom rented this house on Rectory Road. And I've got all these new brothers and sisters. It was Sheila, Richie, Trevor. So all my brother from the West is Doug. But so I had all these new siblings I've never seen. And it was quite incredible, really. It took me quite a while to get used to it. But I got used to it very quick.
What do you mean? Hang on a minute.
Were they blood siblings? Like actual family related?
Well, my mom came over before me.
Oh, I see.
My mom was there 7 years before me. She left when I was three.
Oh, right.
And then sent for me. So she had all these new kids. Turn up and there's have all these new brothers and
huge
sisters.
Family. Crazy.
So your parents like separated and your mum came to the UK?
Yeah.
And you remained in Grenada?
I remained in Grenada with a lovely couple, Muppets and Parklim, who adopted me for 7 years.
Wow.
And was probably the best thing that happened to me. They really loved me and cared for me. Oh. They actually sent back for me when my mum brought me over to London, but my mum wouldn't send me back.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway.
Oh God, yes.
Anyway.
But what did you, can you remember being a kid and feeling like what you wanted?
I never wanted to come to London. I wanted to run away and hide up a tree or something. But the people I live with, Muppets and Parklim, you couldn't do that, you know, because I was well disciplined. You can't do that. So I had to come to London. I mean, in retrospect, I mean, it's amazing that I did come.
Yeah.
I probably, if I stayed, I would have about 20 kids now. Nice. I would have been a farmer, you know, landowner.
You'd have had a house like a church.
Well, exactly.
I guess also you would never have gone to the club scene here. So maybe you would never have started documenting that.
I would have
becoming
never,
the artist you became. So.
I would have never met my partner.
Right.
It's amazing. Coming to London, it's incredible what it has done for me. I mean, all my paintings are about London and the West Indies, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's...
There's one comment I've read that you've spoken about before, which really touched me, which is this concept of nature within a club. So if you're in a club, the mirror ball can somehow break up light. And it's a bit like if you're looking up in a forest through the trees and then you see light refracting
fragmenting
coming through. And I'd never really consciously thought about that. I always think of disco balls being 70s or, you know what I mean? Like disco. And I just think of it more like that. But I never actually thought about the effect of the light.
Yeah.
And that's something that your paintings reveal as well.
Yeah,
because a lot of the times you do all this modern stuff, but basically we're kind of replicating nature.
Yes.
And because I grew up in the country, when it gets dark, it gets dark. And I used to have to take, I lived in the village and I used to go up, I used to have like half an hour to the country house where Parklim lived. So you're sort of like the farmhouse where they do all the cocoa, nutmeg and banana. I used to have to take his lunch up for him and his dinner. So I lived at the townhouse about, say, 4 or 5. And on my way, it's getting dark. And I'm covered by cocoa trees, nutmeg trees, banana trees, and spooky.
Yeah.
And, you know, once it gets dark, all you have is moonlight. And all cracks in the trees, all stuff. You go, your hair is getting, and so you get to the end of the destination and you thank God I made it. But nature is just so spooky. You know, just everything is there, of course. All the animals, they're falling asleep. Oh, you might hear the tree or bamboo. Bamboo, really, they crack against each other. They rub against each other and they make this incredible noise. And if you're in the forest with just the bamboo going...
And you're like under 10 years old at this point.
Awesome. And when you hear the local people talking about stuff that...
spirits or something.
Exactly. And of course, it's just spooky.
Spooky, you scare yourself.
But that's the beautiful thing about... That painting, the painting I did called Three Wicked Men, that's the painting I wrote that bit about. when I did Three Wicked Men, it's basically a dread in the middle and two British cops on the side.
Yes.
And it's set on a London street scene. It's basically real 80s with all the problems they had in Brixton, stop and search.
Yeah.
Where people, I think they stopped about 1,000 a week and arrested about 90. Yeah. So there was lots of unease and stuff. Anyway, so that painting is about that part of London.
Mm. And also you lost a friend, didn't you?
That's Winston Rose, yeah, in 1981. Yeah. But when I did that painting, I was at Royal College. And it was it's a big painting, it's over 4 meters. But it was very spooky doing that painting in an institution like art school, when people are doing like abstract paintings, and I'm painting this big police guys.
Wow.
So I painted it in the summer when no one was there.
Oh, really? Because
in the summer, when people, you have a break, in those days you could go in and use the studio, so there's no tutors and hardly any students.
Oh, that's good.
But you felt like freer in space to do wanted to do.
The subject matter was so toxic. You
really?
Mean, oh, you know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Well, you felt like it was too political for people to really accept at the time, or?
Yeah, well, not only that, but you painting the police and people being arrested and stuff. I didn't consciously realize that. When I look back in retrospect, that's why I couldn't do it with so much people in the room. So, you know, you do things naturally. So I find the right time to do it,
right?
Which is when no one was there. But when I had to do it, all the background spaces. So you have your three main dudes, the three wicked men.
Yeah.
Then I had to sort out the background. I didn't just want a street lamp and a few cobblestones or whatever, or, you know, paving stones. So I had lots of the stuff from the nightclubs. I had a sort of a drug dealer in the background, you know. And then I thought, I've got to do something with the background. I've got to make it more intense. And that's where the forest, the dark night came in. I started doing lift, like mosaic. So when the mosaic ball flicker in the nightclub, you've got those little circular bubbles. So I did them as like lift shape. And then
the light refractions you're talking about.
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So it creates this kind of a night sky. So you kind of mix in a city with a forest. And that's how that came about.
Yeah.
So it's trying to combine two worlds. My world, where I grew up in the West Indies, of course, walking at night in the forest when it's quite spooky. And of course, London streets at night. Well, if you look, you've got to be careful. There's, you know, Babylon is behind you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because, I could come out from a nightclub at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And there's three or four guys in a car driving, cruising behind you. And you got to be very careful what you say to them.
Right.
They say, what you got in that bag? Oh, your pastels and paper. Oh, yeah, pastels and paper. Yeah, you could be screwed up. Yeah.
Wow.
You could, you know, you could jump, dump
stuff. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it never happened to me. The only thing that happened to me once on Dalston, I was drawing in the days when there were all posters, billboards.
Yeah.
I was drawing this amazing billboard. It was like 5-6 meters. I didn't actually know it was attached to a jewellery factory, a jewellery store. So I was drawing this thing and making drawings. I'd take it back to Central and make big paintings. But one day, I draw it, photograph it, got on my bike to go back to Central School of Art. Two police guys grabbed me by the arms and took me to Dalston Police Station.
Really?
And said, what are you doing? Because there's a woman who saw me drawing the billboard and thought, I was drawing plans to steal.
Oh, you were casing the joint.
Casing the joint,
no
yeah.
No way.
Yeah. It was, so they took me down to the station. Then they said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just making drawings to make a painting from. So they didn't believe me. So they showed them all my sketchbooks. There's lots of nudes in it. So they fell apart laughing. Then they tried to get me on a stolen camera. I had a very expensive college camera. So they tried to get me on the stolen camera. They couldn't. They realized I was a true student.
Yeah.
So there's nothing they could do with me. So they chucked me down in the basement in a cell. So I thought, when are they going to flush my head in the toilet or something? But there's always two, one like soft one and one a rough one.
Yeah, good cop, bad cop.
That's it. So one of them came down on me because he was going to punch me in the stomach and stop when he gets to my stomach.
No.
They're just
bullies. Up, bullying, yeah.
So then they kept me for about 2 hours, but I didn't know you're supposed to tell them your name and address. I didn't know that type of stuff. So I think I didn't give them my address or anything.
Right.
So I was charged with insulting language, like swearing. to the police. So I did turn up at Highbury Magistrate Court after about 3 or 4 weeks. And lots of my tutors came to speak on my behalf, saying what a good student it was.
So when was this, the 80s?
That was 70s because I was at Central.
70s, okay.
About 78, finished Central in 79.
Right.
Yeah. So this time, that experience for you, that just sounds like so unjustified and brutal and racial. Yes. But it felt like that experience has sort of defined your artwork, and Rob touched on it, but your friend Winston Rose, who you grew up with, and he died through police brutality.
That's it. In 1981, when I was at the Royal College, I had to write a thesis. I didn't want to write about art anymore because I did an art. When I was at Central during my BA, I wrote about Picasso and Cassegamos, Picasso's best friend when he was a young man. So I wanted to do something else. And I was looking at the local 6 o'clock news one evening, and my friend, who I knew like 3 or 4 years back, which was when I used to live in Rectory Road, when I just came to London, his Winston Rose family lived on the top floor of the house, mm-hmm. and my mom lived on the ground floor and the first floor. I was looking at the local news, and Winston Rose came on, died in police custody. So I thought, oh gosh, he must be only about 27. So I was shocked by the whole thing. So I went to see his family, because he had a younger brother and his mom, to find out more, but I couldn't find out anything because, you know, it was a raw subject matter, you know, so he just avoid it a little. So, well, what can I do? I could do something on Winston Rose, probably. So I went to the inquest at Waltham Forest Magistrate Court with my tape recorder.
Wow.
And I taped the proceedings. Literally, I taped the whole... I didn't want to make things up, you see, because I remember most of it, but the trouble is I didn't want to sort of start imagining things.
Yeah, you want it to be accurate.
I wanted to get it accurate.
Yeah.
So I taped it, and then I did my thesis on it. So after about a week of or 2 weeks of taping it, the last day I was there, suddenly someone in the court reckoned, suspect tape! I thought, God, they found out I'm taping the proceedings.
No.
So I was sitting there all shivering, thinking, oh, they're going to come and get me.
Oh my God.
But they taped the proceedings themselves. And when a tape is finished or they have to change it, they say suspect tape. And they changed. So I just walked up with my tape recorder. I thought, that's it. I'm not coming back.
Yes.
I've had enough now.
Wow.
So I wrote about, in the middle of writing the thesis about Winston Rose and realized how brutally and horribly this guy was killed. I didn't realize it, but I was in a bad state then. So I was doing this massive painting of Jash Acker on the crowd. So Jash Acker was in the middle, his warrior song system and everything. And I thought, oh, why don't I do something for Winston Rose? So I took Jash Acker out, I stick a coffin in the middle of this nightclub painting. And then I used to draw a lot of people falling asleep. You know, you look around in a nightclub, where I used to draw, there's people just falling asleep. They're tired, some of them.
Yeah.
And so I used to draw them, you know, 5-10 minutes, yeah. Got a nice still subject there. And I used one of the drawings I did of someone falling asleep for the head of Winston Rose,
oh, wow.
And then his wife around the coffin and stuff, and all the nightclub. But the nightclub painting really suited it because it was kind of dark. It was like a funeral, you know. I didn't have to create that atmosphere. Because the nightclub, they usually are very dark because there was hardly any electric light. And then, so that was the first painting I did, and I finished writing a thesis. And then I ended up doing, I couldn't have done Three Wicked Men without Winston Rose.
Mm. Right, right, right.
Three Wicked Men came about a year after, and this, because with the burial of Winston Rose I've done in the first year at the Royal College. Then I did two quick drawings, big drawings, like a meter, because the subject matter is so brutal. I mean, they killed this bloke in the back garden. They killed Winston Rose in the back garden, right?
Mm-hmm.
They obviously had to carry him to the van in the front. So four of them lifted him.
He was having a psychotic episode, wasn't he?
That's it. What happened is his job was an electrician, a day job, and then he used to do boxing in the evening.
Right.
Sort of semi-pro.
Uh-huh.
But then he had a blood clot. And then obviously he had problems.
Triggered episodes.
That's right. So he had breakdowns where the mental people used to have to come. Right. And what in those days, what they did, they take you and put you in a small room like this, solitary confinement. And if you've been violent, straight jacket. And then next day you'll come through, they'll let you out and you can go back and meet your family. So that used to happen a lot. So one day he was sitting in his front garden and he saw three or four police guys coming down the street. And of course he thought, oh, they're coming to get me. So he rushed in through his house and went and hide in his back garden shed.
Mm.
And so they couldn't get through the front door. So they went to the back house on the other side of the street, on his back garden, came through the other neighbor's back garden to get into his back garden. And then when he realized that was happening, he rushed out of his shed, but they caught him. And about six of them were on top of him in the back garden. And, well, I don't know how they killed him that way. They reckon he choked on his vomit and stuff like that. Anyway, so they killed him in the back garden, carried him to the van, handcuffed, chucked him down, face down in the van, handcuffed at the back. And in those days, those vans were pretty crude. Four guys got in, either side, two on either side, and their foot on top of him. And how I got that information, the social worker who was new to the job, she came on the scene then and saw she had to get in the front of the van next to the driver. And she looked behind and that's what she saw. And she was in a state of shock herself. So the whole thing was so they killed this guy and now they put their foot on top of him, taking him to wherever the police. Halfway there, they reckons, oh, he hasn't got a pulse. He's handcuffed. Mm. They lost the keys. Anyway, they killed him already. But so the whole thing was it was horrible. Yeah. Anyway, so I did quite a few of the police van from an aerial perspective. So you can see the police sitting in the van, and then Winston Rose on the floor, and then the driver and the social worker.
You can see her staring back.
Yeah, you can see her staring back.
He looks like a Christ-like kind of vision. Yeah, yeah.
You start doing these things and you could see where people do it all, it comes around, it's like, the stars at night through the trees, that position is always Christ. You're not doing Christ, but that's how it comes about.
Yeah,
it comes about,
And in a way, it's such an incredible tribute to his memory as well. And the fact that his story, we're still talking about it right now, thanks to your paintings, and your drawings and your art.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And then also recently in Brixton, you've just had a mural installed that you've created in Brixton Station.
Which is
Three Wicked Men. It's like a response, a more recent...
I did another version. London Underground contacted me about a year ago. I've been avoiding them for quite a while because I don't like... I always paint what I want to paint.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't paint for
commissions.
New commissions. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just do what I... So that's why I didn't contact them. But Matthew Higgs said, oh, you must do it. So what? All right. If Matthew wants me to do it, because Matthew's a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
So I thought, what can I do? And then me and my partner, Philippa, we start thinking about all the paintings that I've done. Has to be Three Wicked Men.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done four versions already. So I thought, I could do another version.
Oh, have? You've done four versions of Three Wicked Men?
Yeah.
So are they like Three Wicked Men 1, 2, 3, 4? How have you titled them?
Well, There is one call from Trench Down to Porth Down. You know, I moved to Cornwall.
Yeah, to Truro, right.
My local beach is Porth Down.
Right.
I've got three wicked men on Porth Down Beach, and I've called it from Trench Down to Porth Down.
Yeah, good.
So you've got the three wicked men.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing, I thought I'll do a painting of my local beach.
Uh-huh.
So I went and drew all the people on my beach.
Mm-hmm.
But I did them in the kind of nightclub style, quick, but a bit longer. And I started the painting of all these people on the beach and the sea. The best thing about the painting was the horizon. When the sky meets the sea, it's not level, it's diagonal. And that was the most exciting part about it. But the rest of the painting wasn't moving me. So I thought, what the hell can I do with this painting? I'm not being moved. Why don't I bring the three wicked men to Porth Down?
Amazing.
So I superimpose, I draw the three wicked men on the beach on top of all these people lying on the beach.
Wow.
And of course, they're quite big and vertical. And people are on the beach, they're lying down and they're doing this.
Mm.
So suddenly the painting came alive. Amazing. Because you got all this different perspective.
Yeah.
And they were right up front. And it gave the painting an energy which it needed. So that one was done in 2017. I think it's 2017 or 2016.
How long did that take to paint, that one?
It must take me about 2 months.
Okay,
it takes me long.
And is that normal time for you to do a painting?
Yeah, for 6, 7, 8 weeks. Yeah, 2 months. Working every day. Working every day.
Wow.
Yeah, working every day. So that's the... So when I decided to do the Brixton, London Underground, for Brixton,
yeah,
I decided three wicked men will really work with Brixton, particularly with all the stuff in the 80s. I just told you about when Stop and Search and all that type of stuff. But I had to update it. So I had Jashaka, like a DJ like Jashaka.
Jashaka's back.
Yeah, so if anything, he's Jashaka anyway. But it's a DJ in the background. I had a youth with his mobile phone.
Uh-huh.
And I've changed it slightly. I made it much sharper. The light is much more diagonal and vertical things happening in it. Yeah.
Is Winston Rose in that one? Does he appear?
Well, Winston Rose is really the Dread. That's what I was saying. I couldn't have done that painting
without him. Yeah.
Without going through what I did with Winston Rose. So Winston Rose, I did the burial in 1981.
Yeah.
So the drawing for three wicked men, I didn't do the original drawing. The original drawing was an A4 paper. Was done by my brother when he was about 15, probably 13.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The three wicked men is a politician.
The politician, the businessman.
And the policeman.
And the policeman, right. Yeah. And there's a reggae record about it as well. There is a record.
Is it Bad Guys or something? No.
Well, what's the course on the politician?
They're
not good, are they?
No, I mean the song title.
I think it's the Jamaican politics.
Okay.
Because you remember Bob Marley was trying to connect Mandley and Ciago or whatever.
Yeah.
Because Jamaican have a lot of, anyway, wrong that time. So I think Three Wicked Men is about a lot of the stuff to do with Jamaican politics at the time. But so Jashaka used to play Three Wicked Men, you see.
Right.
So that's where the title comes from.
Right.
Because I always try and get my title to work with a record. So when I'm thinking about a title for my paintings, I start thinking about records. Mm. And in those days, they used to do remix. They'll do 5, 6 versions. They'll compete with each other to do versions.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the version. That's why I did lots of different three. I wasn't doing it, but when you're in a cycle of doing things where people are doing it, you naturally will do it without you having to think about doing it. Because the atmosphere around you just absorb it and you do it.
Yeah.
And so I was doing it, I was trying to do what I was doing in my painting, they were doing in the music, in the record.
It was like autonomous. It just became like a... That's what I was saying about you going into a trance-like state with the music, is that the music connected with your hand, connected with the drawings. It's like this whole harnessing of energy.
I couldn't have done... So my brother did the original drawing on an A4 paper in Biro, blue ink, and I looked at it. After that, so I did the burial... And I saw this little drawing. Kids do drawings, kids' drawings are to do with what they see in society.
Yeah,
they don't make things up.
No, you're right.
They see it.
And in the family home as well.
And I thought, God, that's Winston Rose.
Wow.
So I took this drawing and just worked on it and worked on it and changed it and made it, well, so big. But actually, it's still there in the small joint. So you got the dread, two policemen, and there is a flat, a little council flat in the background.
And the mural in Brixton is called Brixton Blue.
Brixton Blue.
Yeah, and it is incredible. It's got so many different types of blue in it as well. It's like such an amazing colour, isn't it? It has such an impact when you're walking
Brixton's
down the
stairs. Brixton's Victoria line.
And also it's still really relevant to today because young men and women are still being stopped on the streets regularly, mainly men, I think.
Well, history hasn't seemed to change.
No, so it's a really relevant artwork.
Well, when I was doing the London Underground painting, Brixton Blue, I was thinking in the 70s, there used to be, because, you know, a lot of, they brought people over from the West Indies to work on London Transport.
Right.
And I was shocked. I was doing, in the middle of doing the painting, I thought, yes, I used to remember those guys with their big hats, you know, those dread with their big hats with the London Underground logo. Because, you know, there used to be a lot of black people used to really drive buses and not when you had a conductor doing his, but I mean, you don't have that now. So it was interesting because a lot of them were brought over in after the Second World War, 50s, the Windrush lot for jobs to run the London Underground and the trains and the hospital.
So one of the things that really struck me about your work is I think it's really difficult to paint sound. And there's obviously iconic paintings, like if you think of The Scream by Edvard Munch, and there's certain works in the history. But your work really, to me, like I can imagine what it sounds like somehow. And it's also very much about light, of course. And it's interesting if you're in a basement, you know, this idea of light and the restriction of light and how that ends up really giving you parameters to work within, I guess, within your work. But how important is that idea of painting sound to you?
Oh, well, that's one of the things I think made me want to paint those spaces and those people, because half of it was the music. That was the first thing. Because like I said, when I just came to London, I was 11, and I couldn't go to school until I was 12 because I was the wrong age. So I stayed at home for about 3 or 4 months, and my mom taught me to sew bags. You know, shopping bags?
Yeah.
Before plastic bags. They were made by people in factories. So that's why my mom, like a cottage industry, she used to make it in the basement in her house.
Wow.
She worked for this lovely Jewish family, used to bring everything cut.
This is in Stoke Newington.
In Stoke Newington. Yeah. So my mom taught me to make bloody bags.
Wow.
And I was faster at making bags than my mom.
Could you make a bag now?
Oh, of course, yeah. Once you learn to do it, you never forget it.
It's like riding a bike.
Make a bag, riding a bike,
And to keep me sweet, you know, keep me entertained, I saw the latest Bob Marley records with my little song system beside me. And look, you remember I told you I used to do all my mom rocksteady parties.
Yeah.
So I used to have, you know, my mom little disco, my mom little 45s, you know, small records, 45. So I started really getting into music then. And then, of course, when dub came in, I mean, it was so exciting, dub music. You know, the distortions, the messing about, the B-side, you know. Augustus Pablo was just an amazing, you know, those mix of King Tubby and Augustus Pablo. Oh, gosh, you put the B-side on and you're in heaven.
Yeah.
And so when I went to these nightclubs, I thought, shit, that's why I have to paint, the sound, the movement, the action. You know, when the early paintings were quite static.
Yeah,
because I was so into, I suppose, the figures as well. But as I keep doing, and that's a good thing about us, I'm telling you about the doing of it. Most of what artists do is doing, making. So if you were there drawing, you actually are getting into it without actually you having to force it. Because you're there, because I love dance as well, you see.
Yeah.
I used to do a lot of, but once I started painting, I had to give it up.
Anyway. Would you be having a little bop while you're drawing?
Well, exactly. I'm terrible. Anyway, so the drawings, making the drawings on the spot was the thing that helped to connect me with the big pack. Because if I didn't go to this nightclub and do the drawings, I couldn't have made those paintings.
Right. And there's an energy in the paintings, which is very dynamic and very fast in a sense. Like you feel the movement. It's as if they are moving as you're looking at them. And that is
it's
obviously
like
from this process of drawing, which is so fast. You're talking about the length of a record, like 3, 4 minutes, 5 minutes.
And that's a rule you set yourself.
Yeah. Well, 80% of the drawings I never touch. Because when I do these drawings, remember, it's dark.
Yeah.
I hardly could see what
you
I'm doing.
Yeah, so you'd only see them when you got home.
And I heard that you didn't always know what colour pencil you'd use. So sometimes you'd come out and it would be in pink or green and you wouldn't even know what colour it was.
You'll have lots and lots of pastels around you. And you just go for the feel. You know vaguely where certain colours are, but after a while you don't care really.
Yeah.
Because the music takes over, the feeling takes over, and you have to do it. You don't want to start thinking. Because once you think, the intellect takes over.
Yeah.
You just want to go with the feeling. So I'll do about 40 a night. I'll get home, whacked out, go to sleep.
40?
Drawings. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I'll be there.
It's almost like stream of consciousness.
That's what I'm saying.
It's kind of like poetry.
Like an inner monologue.
Yeah,
sort of
yeah,
like.
Well,
remember, I'll be there from about 11 till about 4, 5 in the morning. So, wow.
And would you drink or energy drinks or how would you see yourself through
that? I usually take something. I think I used to take a beer or something with me because I didn't have enough money to go to the bar and buy a drink. So I used to have a plastic bag with my paper. I usually have something in there. You know, usually I think it's a beer or some water or something. Because you have to keep going.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, you know, it's, I knew I had to do it to make the painting. So I'll do about, say, 40 a night. Then I'll take them to my house, go to bed, wake up next morning and say about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, that will be the first time I'm seeing them properly.
Right.
So to make paintings from them, I'll select about 4 or 5, stick them up on the wall, you know, next to the painting and make paintings from them. But I mean, all these drawings, I've kept them. I never destroyed any.
It's amazing.
Because sometimes when you just do something, you don't know what you have done.
No.
And you might, if you keep them all in 5, 10, 15, even now, I look at one and I think, oh, yeah, it got that energy. But you wouldn't have seen it
at the time.
Yeah.
The ones you would have seen at the time are very different from the ones you sort of put aside and didn't think nothing much of, but you still kept them.
Yeah.
So it's good when you make drawings like that, is to keep them and look at them in about 4 or 5, because you don't actually know what you have done.
Right.
And particularly when, I mean, that's the amazing thing about, like I was saying, like what Peter Doig met with me, because it's like taking care of your painting. Mm. It's so important, you know, because...
Well, they're your babies, aren't they?
Well, exactly. And, you know, and people think you only have to have a studio to paint. But if you're making lots of paintings and you're not selling them, you have to actually put them in a safe place.
But now you are selling them. What does that feel like, letting them go?
I'm glad to let them go.
Oh, you are?
Is it a relief?
Well, they're going to special places.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, it's amazing, really.
And I guess there's other people taking care of them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're going to special places because, you know, I'm having an exhibition in Nottingham now.
Yep.
Yes, it's so exciting. Yeah. And you're also going on to Spike Island as well.
That's
in
it.
In Bristol,
yeah.
Well, so you're doing Nottingham Contemporary followed by Spike Island.
Yeah, a lot of the paintings are coming back.
Yeah.
So it'd be nice, you know, like some of those at Matthew. So.
Oh, from private collections. They're
being
borrowed.
So, wow. Yeah, so a lot of them might be coming back. Probably
like
about
old
4 or 5.
Friends.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's great that the people are actually acquiring the paintings. It's the best thing that happens because there's only so much you can do, really. Mm. You know, I mean, like I said, I've been taking care of them for over 40 years. You know, so it's great.
You can let them go now.
And also, you've got all your drawings, so you can always
go back. How many drawings have you got?
Yeah.
Hundreds. Well, the gallery's got them now.
Yeah. So the gallery's got the responsibility. So now you sign with Stephen Freeman, they have the responsibility for storing your works.
Yeah.
You don't have to look after them anymore.
No, the gallery takes care of them.
Well, that must be a relief. You've now got to give this barn back you've been renting for the past 40 years.
Oh, God.
I was really fascinated by the idea as well that the drawings are so fast and then you make these very kind of like slow paintings that might take months to finish.
Exactly.
And also the kind of intellectual rigour that comes with that and then your colour choices, because you as a colorist, and one of our questions we're going to ask you in a minute is about color as well. But I love your choices of color to take you to a place to like transform your, you know, what you're seeing into this kind of like space, like a room you're entering almost.
Yeah, with color, it's in you. You don't actually know if you are good at it or not till just doing it and doing it and doing it. And I suppose being born in the West Indies. I mean, the West Indies is a bright, sunny place. And, you know, I mean, the colour, I mean, the blue sky and the sea water, turquoise, transparent. You know, so everything was very clear and sharp. Like we said, coming to London, where everything is... Because London is a very dark... I mean, it's colourful, but it's a grey. Everything has a bit of grey in it.
Mm.
You know, it does. And so A lot of the nightclub painting, of course, which were very dark paintings, but they are dark but still rich in colour.
Well, that's because of people were wearing, you're saying, because of their regalia.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, some people come dressed like, you know, an African prince or an African princess, you know, and you think, oh, that colour is so lovely.
Wow. And that idea of clothing is so present in your work, and also the dance movements. But I was thinking a lot about, there's a young fashion designer now called Nicholas Daly.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever come across him, but he's amazing. I'm actually wearing his corduroy trousers right now.
Oh.
But he's really inspired by music and club scenes and reggae and dub, and it all inspires his style. And he's a really young designer. He's one of my favourite designers. And he's using a lot of, like, textile mills within the UK and all this kind of history
good.
Of fabrics and stuff. But I think you'd really respond to what he's doing. And he makes collages of photographs from the 60s, 70s, 80s. Mm. And he's very much looking back to that era that I guess he wasn't part of and that he's following on from. It's really cool.
Yeah.
But I really like that in your work as well, the kind of the style of the clothes.
I think a lot of the... When I started using I used lots of oranges and yellows. When I started doing... I did a painting called Witch Doctor. Basically, I tried to connect the nightclub scene with the Notting Hill scene. You know, Notting Hill Carnival, I used to go to that every year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Notting Hill Carnival, I just used to love it because, you know, you've got your song system on the street corner.
Yeah.
And there used to be houses that are decked in flags and stuff like that. So I used to go there and I did drawings as well, very quick. I did this painting called Witch Doctor, which is basically two massive speakers and the DJ in the middle. And a few dancing figures on the side. And that's one of the first paintings where I started I'm trying to paint it in daylight as opposed to night scene. Mm. And that painting helped me a lot to take me back to the West Indies, basically. And I start thinking about all these bright colours. And then, of course, I went to Italy for 2 years, Rome. And, of course, Rome has got a beautiful light.
Yeah.
Mm. Not like London.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in Rome, I did Carnival Dub. Carnival Dub is just oranges and yellow, like four big. I did one of my biggest paintings is about 4 meters square, probably five. I did four massive big speakers on each corner of the canvas. It's aerial view and sort of a dread coming out like a vortex in the middle with the woman.
Wow.
And then the painting changed. Then I did someone doing a monkey dance. But that painting helped me to take me back to Carnival in the West Indies and Notting Hill, mixing the nightclub scene with the daylight scene. But being in Rome helped me a lot to use colour.
And what actually took you to Rome? Was there a residency or something?
A scholarship, didn't you?
The Rome Fellowship. The Rome Fellowship is amazing. Well, it's a year now, but when I had it, it was 2 years. You get a massive...
Is that the British school at Rome?
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, I know it.
It's government funded. Yes. It's in Villa
Borghese.
It's
still going, is it?
Yeah, because, you know, Catherine Story went on it, and a few people we know have been on it. I think Eddie Peake might have done it.
Wow.
It's one of the best fellowships you can get.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is set up for you. You've got a big studio.
For 2 years?
When it was 2 years then. It's 1 year now.
It's 1 year now. Yeah. But when I had it, it was amazing. Before the Euro.
So right.
Everything was dirt cheap.
Yeah, cool.
And the food's so good as well.
So it was the lira.
And they had siestas.
I love a siesta.
Three hours during the day, there's nothing on the street. You just walk down the Corso. There's nothing on the Corso. You know, it's like the equivalent to Oxford Street.
Mm.
Oh,
and as a painter, you must have seen so many great paintings as well, because there's so much sort of rich culture in Italy.
Oh, God.
And like you just turn the corner and there's a Haagen-Dazs and then there's the Trevi Fountain, which is just amazing.
When I was there, you could just walk into a church and there's a Caravaggio.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's what I do. I go there to do that. Yeah, it's my favourite thing.
There's a Caravaggio just there.
I know, and you just sit in front of it for hours. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It was such an inspiring, and all the lovely Bernini piazzas.
Yes.
With all those lovely big muscular figures spouting water and blowing this conch shell.
Yeah, we love that.
That was what Michael Stipe wanted. It was a Bernini sculpture.
Oh, really?
That was what his art heist was. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get on
the singer
from
R.E.M.
We ask every guest that comes on, Denzel, we ask them if they could do an art heist, their touchstone artwork that they could steal and take home.
Yeah.
We would help you do it. What would it be and why?
Oh, we love to be a Van Gogh.
Oh, yeah.
It's a portrait of him when he just cut his ear off.
Oh,
so
yes.
He's a bandage head.
Yes, yes, yes.
So he was in a pretty bad state then.
Yeah.
So he's wearing his bandage across his head. He's got his Russian Cossack hat and his peasant style coat with one button. But he must have been going through a pretty. Because it's not the paint quality doesn't look as good as his other portraits. And in the background, I think there's sort of kind of Japanese or more oriental painting that influenced him a lot at the back. But I think it was a big transition for him because I think he just, split up with Gauguin, I think probably the thing had come to an end.
Yeah.
And so it must have been so that painting, I think, has a lot going on to do with him and his life, because he's such a sort of such a creative person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such raw emotion.
Where have you seen this? Have you seen it in the flesh?
I think when I was at Central, we went to Amsterdam.
Yeah, just to the Van Gogh Museum.
Yeah. But his paintings, when you look at them, they look as if they're just painted.
Yeah, they do.
Fresh.
Yeah. Oh, they still look wet, don't they?
Like they're drying.
You can always smell the paint.
Yeah.
No. So, But I think that's the one I would take. I mean, some of his peasant women digging in the earth with a spade, they remind me of some of my figures in the nightclub, because they're always from the back and they're digging in. There's lots of movement. They've got a hell of... Well, his brush mark is always, always gestural, moving.
Yeah.
No, but definitely Van Gogh. I mean, he only had 10 years to do what he did, and it's just amazing.
Are there other artists that really inspired you to want to make
it? When I just started, I don't know, 14, 15, Leonardo da Vinci.
Really? Leonardo da Vinci? Wow.
You've always been aiming quite high.
Right, yeah.
I did a portrait of me in the Leonardo da Vinci style.
Have you still got it?
Yeah, I've made my afro and everything. I still have it. And then I did one of a North African starving woman in that style. My brother's got that in his flat.
Wow.
And then I did Da Vinci for about a year. You know, it's always good when you're starting to be inspired by some of this amazing artist. And then, of course, I got into Cubism big time. I love Cubism.
So Picasso and...
There's still flavours of that in my work.
Yeah, you can definitely see that. Yes.
Love Picasso. I mean, he was the one who turned people onto African art, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise in this country, they would never look at it.
Well, he went to one that took a tribal mask back from Africa, and then that was his inspiration for all of his faces.
No, Picasso is just amazing. Yeah, so I was turning on my Picasso for quite a while. So I did lots of cubistic style painting at the beginning of Central. And then we used to go to France quite a lot. Cézanne. I did a lot of my back garden in Stoke Newington, in the sort of Monet Cézanne style. I still have them.
You used to paint your garden. Wow.
But when I saw Picasso's, Picasso has a lovely collection. There's a lovely Matisse painting. It's a still life. It's a little ball. It's about under 2 feet. But it's like a stained glass, the colours. Very black lines and strong bold colours. But Picasso had a lovely collection of stuff that of his own.
He must have done trades.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Wheeling and dealing. That was a very inspiring time for me when I was at Central, because this was like a transition. I was searching for something. I was searching for the nightclubs, you see.
Yeah.
Once a fun, because I found the nightclubs in the middle of Central instead of 77. Mm. Yeah. That's when I found...
And your work changed then?
What did
the tutors say? Were they like, hang on a minute, there's something going on different now in your work. What's happened?
I think they must have, because my BA show, I had two of my nightclub paintings in, a small one about a metre and one big one. I think they knew something had changed, because the one that I think they liked a lot was a small nightclub one, which I capture. It's very dark. It's all blue. It's all, and that one, I got a lot of good response for that.
Mm.
Plus, I got a one, you see. So they must have really thought something has happened.
The first.
Are you first? Yeah. Really? Oh, wow. Cool.
Legend.
Legendary. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Well, at the moment, it's blue.
Yes.
Because we're Brixton blue.
Yeah.
But I've been doing a lot of blue paintings since I retired. Most of the paintings are like 80% blue.
Was that a conscious decision or did it happen naturally?
No. It happens emotionally when you work. Well, if I think when I was in Rome, and after Rome, I went to America, Harkness Fellowship, it's oranges and yellows.
Yeah.
You know, I've just come from my gallery, Stephen Friedman, and there's three of my paintings there. And I'm thinking, oh, blue is my favorite color now, but these paintings are all oranges and yellows. For shit.
Feels quite alien now.
But it just shows you, you don't realize it. You might have a favorite color for 4 or 5 years and then it changes. But I think blue might be more constant. Three Wicked Men.
I think so. Yeah. I think I can see blue in your
there's
work.
A lot of, there's like a thread throughout your creativity.
And that blue painting I just told you I did at my tutor's, like, what was in my BA show at Central. Blue have been very dominant, I think, throughout my... Although I love those bright colours when I see them, it seems... I think, Winston Rose as well. I suppose to do it. I did a lot of dark paintings because of Winston Rose. And it was the amazing thing, I think, was going to Rome. Getting the Rome Fellowship was so good for me because I was doing all that Winston Rose stuff. And I was looking for that type of subject matter. But because the beautiful thing about me and Winston Rose, I grew up with him for about 4 or 5, so I knew him. Mm. So I wasn't painting about someone I didn't know. Yes. He meant something to me. And when I finished the Royal College, I was looking, because I was thinking about doing Biko, you know, Steve Biko, because he died in horrible circumstances.
Mm. He was a South African activist, wasn't
That's
he?
That's it. He was killed in...
He was assassinated, yeah.
Yeah. So I
but was, because you didn't know him, it harder to...
Yeah, and I find myself being too intellectual about it. I thought, no, I'm not going to do it. But the good thing was I was sent to Rome.
It released you. It sort of gave you a sort of release.
Yeah, it took me out from my natural environment. And I thought, God, I'm dying to paint the clubs.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm dying to paint all the dub scenes.
Look back at... You know, London from afar.
That's
and
it.
You
it
see it from a distance.
Yeah.
And then you can
sort of nostalgic. Yeah. More nostalgic.
When
dream-like,
you're away from home,
yeah.
Oh, you miss it so much. Yeah. It was so exciting being here. Guys, to come back for Christmas and go to all the clubs.
When was the last time you painted a club or drew in a club?
Well, about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, really? That's where?
Ludbrook Grove, Jashaka.
Right. Yeah, so you went back in there and
that's
you got your.
I,
oh,
that's
wow.
What I was saying. I hadn't drawn Jashaka for over.
Does he know? Has he got any of your work?
No.
Is he aware of you, though? He must be.
Because his PA, Nikki, she's an amazing woman.
Yeah.
She's been with him for 30 years.
Yeah.
She organised all his dues.
Yeah.
She's an incredible woman. I met her, and she told me that he was playing. She sent me an email.
Oh.
And I came all the way from Cornwall to go to it. Yeah, it's Ludbrook Grove. There's a club there beneath the Notting Hill Flyover. It's an amazing place. And so I hadn't drawn Jashaka for over 25 years, I think.
Oh,
so I've got it on video. Nikki, I'm recorded it. I'll send it to you later.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, this is amazing.
It's
I think
such
you're
such a privilege to
you're
speak
just,
to you.
Yeah, you're an amazing, amazing artist, a wonderful man. But also what your art is kind of documenting British history, but especially Black British history. And you've been there the whole time. And you're an asset to the kind of the history, do you know what I mean, of Britain.
Yeah, and your paintings are going to live on beyond all of us.
Yeah.
I think that, like we were saying, it's so great that you're able to keep the messages alive.
It's interesting when you do something not realizing you're recording a part of history.
Mm.
Like, but only recently.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like 20 years ago.
I know, but it's fascinating how those buildings are no longer in use. You know, like, those clubs have gone and at least they're still alive and remembered through your paintings.
And especially, and anyone going through Brixton Station or going down to the underground off the high street, you can see Brixton Blue, the mural, as you go down the stairs. And how long is it there for? How long does it
take? 2020, isn't it?
For a year.
Do you ever? Is it
September next year?
Yeah,
great. Because the artist
still
before Njeka Akinyele Crosby had the mural before.
I think those ones were 6 months.
They're 6 months. You got a year.
They've extended to a year.
Legend.
So please go visit Brixton Station, everybody.
And get a picture with Brixton Blue and
So
next
work.
For you is Notting Contemporary and then Spike Island.
Spike Island, yeah.
And you're working to anything beyond that, or that's enough for the moment?
Well, it's enough for the moment because I've about six or eight paintings will be new in Nottingham and Spike Island.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it takes me about just over a month to do a new painting.
Mm-hmm.
So it does take quite a while. But the nice thing about my stage, I've got all this work. You know, if I was probably in my 20s and 30s, I'll be regurgitating things. But I'm not going to be fooled and messed about with in this time of my life. You know, I cannot be used and abused.
No, good.
But when you're young, you know, you're very vulnerable. you're very vulnerable, you know, and you think, oh, I'll chuck them out, I'll keep turning, you know.
Do you have advice for a young artist now then listening? What would you say?
You must follow your heart, follow your soul, find the stuff that really means something. There's no point. You're only here for seconds. You got to do what means something to you. I did it without actually knowing I was doing it, basically. Because that's what lasts, because it's to do with coming from deep inside you. You know, it's, you know, transcending stuff. And it connects to everything.
Yeah.
Once you do it, it connects to everything. And you could keep doing it without, what am I going to paint today? Mm. What am I going to paint? Mm. Because it's very difficult finding, you know. Because, I mean, that was a good thing about when me being in art school, being influenced by all these interesting artists. They helped me to find myself, you know. So in the beginning, you got to be influenced by interesting people.
Yeah.
You know, people you found, oh, yeah, well, I like this one. But it helps you to get on to the where you want to go to.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. You need to learn from all those greats and then work out your own voice.
Yeah.
And I think also when you follow your heart, like you say, I think the audience, not that the audience is important at that point, but the audience will end up receiving it and feeling it and being touched by it. And you'll end up changing things in a way and influencing other people, I guess. But because it's authentic and it's come from a true place.
Yeah, we all know when we stand in something that is actually speaking to us.
Exactly, yeah. As,
you know, because a lot of the time you'll stand there and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And you think, fucking hell, what am I doing here?
Mm. Well, we're happy you are here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We absolutely love you and we feel like you definitely are here and we're so excited you are.
It's been such an inspiring conversation.
Thank you so much for coming on.
I feel very uplifted.
Thanks for coming all the way from Truro in Cornwall.
Yeah.
My God.
No, it's lovely. It's lovely because I can go back and get on to my canvas now.
Yeah.
You know, that's a nice thing about being in Cornwall.
And before you get to do that, we are going to take a picture with you, but we're actually recording in King's Cross, and when you walked in, you saw a huge speaker system.
That's it.
That you responded to.
Oh,
yeah, it's like one of your paintings.
I must have those.
We have to get a picture there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We'll be posting pictures of all the artworks we've spoken about on our Instagram, @talkart. And you can also see Denzel's work on Stephen Friedman's Instagram.
Yes.
Are you on Instagram yourself? Probably not.
No.
I wouldn't imagine you are.
No,
I think you're too busy painting.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And then, as you said, Brixton Underground Station at the minute. Yeah. That's up till September 2020.
Yeah, which is not on the Underground project.
Yes.
And thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Great privilege to spend time with you.
And, thank you, everyone.
Looking forward to seeing your show in Nottingham.
Yeah.
And we'll be back very soon.
Right, big love.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram @talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.